Brian, good morning. How are things?
Good. How are you guys?
We're doing well. We're doing okay here. The Hockey Hall of Fame opens its doors yesterday. Jerome Iginla, at least here in Calgary, as you can appreciate, we never had any doubts that he would go in on the first ballot. You're part of that selection committee. I know you have to be somewhat guarded about it, but this had to have been somewhat easy, I would think, on the behalf of the Hall of Fame committee.
Yeah, we're not allowed to talk about the actual process or who was nominated or who said what. Obviously, there's strict confidentiality rules, but I think it's safe to say going in, most of us thought that this was going to be a very short discussion, and in fact it was. And when you do these meetings, and it cracks me up because inevitably the next day you're hammered for the people that didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
How come this guy didn't get in, this guy didn't get in? And you know, like, we have our own process, our own criteria, and I always tell people the same thing. Well, leave me your number, and the day I start worrying about your thoughts on who should go into the Hall of Fame, I'll call you. So there's always a one or two easy ones, like Haley Wickenheiser, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Niedermeyer, come on.
Yeah.
Why are we wasting time on this? And Jerome was in that category. But there's always some hard ones, too. There was a lot of soul searching, and the people on the selection committee worked very hard. They put a lot of work and a lot of preparation into it. And I think we got it right. I think we got a great class. Now, are there other people that are deserving that might get in down the road? Of course. But I thought we did a great class here. I was very happy.
Now, you're new to the process. Anything surprise you? Was there any part of it that kind of, or intrigued you, maybe that you enjoyed more than anything else?
No, I think this is my sixth or seventh year, so I'm not that new.
Yeah.
My first meeting, I was very impressed with the whole process. It's the coolest thing that I've done in my professional career. I don't mean like winning a Stanley Cup or anything like that, but as far as researching these great players, and then you get to meet them all, and it's the coolest part of my job. I tell people that. Not the most important part when I ran teams, but the coolest part. And I was really impressed by the gravity and the attention that was paid. Like, Eric Duhatchik was on the committee when I joined, and the preparation he would put into this meeting and studying and reading the materials and researching the candidates and the intensity of the discussion, it's very impressive. So I think people, it's like my first GM meeting. When I went to my first GM meeting, I was amazed at how much time these guys had put in to prepare for this meeting and the different topics. I was amazed at how serious it was. The gravity of how important the game of hockey was to these guys was amazing. And that's what I felt my first selection committee meeting.
I remember, again, just because that kind of piqued my interest here, you were talking about the GM meetings, and I remember Jay Feaster said he went to his first as an assistant GM and went to sit at the table, and I think he said that it was you that kind of came over and kind of quietly but under your breath, like, the assistants sit here, just a heads up. And he really appreciated that because it can be, it's over, like you say, when you're new to the party, it's overwhelming and intimidating.
Yeah, I remember that, And I like Jay. Jay was a really good guy and is. I mean, since it's talking past tense, but I remember Jeff Gordon's first meeting. He didn't have a tie on. And now no one wears ties. But back when Jeff became a GM, the guys still mostly wore ties. So I just said to him, you might want to stop in the hotel gift shop there and buy a cheap tie and wear a tie. So
yeah.
He told me afterwards, he said, I felt much better when I went there. Because about back in the day, probably 90% of the guys had a suit on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's much more casual.
Who are some of the intimidating forces we'll stick with the GM for now, in the GM's meetings, guys that really kind of held the power in that room?
Well, it shifted over time. Like when I first, my first GM meeting was 92, 93. And I remember my first meeting, we were in Tampa. Tampa came into the league that year. We had a meeting in St. Petersburg. We were a fancy old, famous old hotel. And I was trying to make the Sean Burke deal. And I had to have a long conversation with Sean Burke before I would do the deal. And so it ran over. I was late for my first meeting. So it's like, I think the meeting started at 10. Sean was in Arizona or someplace. And we were on the phone with him and his agent. And so I was late for the meeting. And Phil Esposito just ripped me. Just ripped me for coming in. So you can't even be on time for your first meeting. And here I'm trying to make this deal with New Jersey. I can't even tell people while I was late. But the guy that had a lot of a lot of sway and a lot of clout was Bill Torrey, the late, great Bill Torrey. And he was a real gentleman. He didn't swear. He was very calm, but when he spoke, people listened. Harry Sinden, same thing. Harry Sinden is so bright, so smart. Glenn Sather, of course, everyone was terrified of Glenn. Bob Gainey was a big presence in the room, but such a nice guy that no one was afraid of him. Ronnie Caron was the guy that intimidated people. He was like, "You talk like this,
yeah,
Harry,
yeah.
How are you?" And,
yeah.
"Hi, Brian, how are you?" And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, I was going to say some guys would have it because of, you know, a little bombastic, and other guys like Torrey, like you would say, wouldn't need to say a word. They would just have that that air of the gravitas when they walk into a room.
Yeah, for sure.
So as far as the Hall of Fame, like you said, there's some no-brainers and there's some easy ones. Obviously, some conversations last long. I guess just tell us about, without details, but just the Jerome one. It would have to be pretty much a consensus, I would think. Not much in the way of humming or hawing.
No. I mean, it just if you and I were sitting in a bar over a beer, if we ever get to do that again.
Yeah.
You know, talking about Jerome McGinley, that's, you know, just 600 plus goals. I mean, that's an automatic, almost an automatic. We hand you the 4-digit code to the front door at the hall. But the other stuff too, the captain, first African Canadian captain, captain of the Flames for years and years and years, the community stuff, the toughness. I mean, that's the whole package. If you look at the description for selection or induction to the Hockey Hall of Fame, it includes sportsmanship and character, and he just checked all the boxes. I'm so happy for him.
Chatting with Brian Burke here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Ryan Pinder.
Brian, so one of the things that confused me about the process, in a lot of other sports, you have a limited amount of time to get in. And in the Hockey Hall of Fame, you stay on the ballot seemingly forever. Like Rogie Vachon, 30-plus years after he retires, gets in. And then this year's class, two guys that a couple decades beyond their retirement get in. Why is that the way it is, and are you okay with it that way? And how would a guy become a Hall of Famer when he was up for it, say, 20 times and was deemed not a Hall of Famer, say, 20 times prior?
Well, what I like about our thing is that you're never out of the running. And you know, certain – I think what happened is I think people focused in more on the two defensemen and the materials that were circulated and what they meant to their teams. And I think a lot of it is not the strength of the presentation in the room. You should not get into the Hockey Hall of Fame just because someone makes a good presentation on your behalf, but the materials you assemble. And then we do research too. Remember, I told the story on the radio yesterday. I remember when Mark Messier played for me in Vancouver. And I said to him one day, I was sitting next to him in his stall just having a coffee, and I said, who ran that team? Well, it was Five Cups in Edmonton. Who ran the room? Was it you? And he said, nope. I said, Gretz? He said, nope. He said, Kevin Lowe. And Kevin Lowe was a great defender, an elite defender, was the first defense pairing, played against all the other teams' top line, still had decent numbers. And people are saying, oh, well, he doesn't have the numbers to be there. Well, he's a much better defender than any of those guys with big point totals. And Doug Wilson, on the other hand, was a guy that the team never got very far, and that's a GM's fault. That's not his fault. But this is a guy who was a dominant offensive defenseman and got ignored because there were guys like Warren Bork and Langway playing in that same era. So I think it was an oversight. I don't think it's a case of we got to find a way to fit these guys in. These guys are legitimate Hall of Famers, and I think it was an oversight that they were out this long.
Do you think that the Hall made a mistake like almost 20 times on these guys, or there just were tougher classes to get in prior?
Well, a lot of it's the class that's going in. Okay, so I gave this example too. So let's say at the end of next year, Marlowe, Thornton, and Jágr officially retire, and 3 years later they're eligible. You want to be a candidate for the admission that year? There's one spot open, guys. I can tell you right now, they're only allowed four men. So if those three retire the same year and wait the same period of 3 years for their eligibility, there's only one person going in that year besides those three. They're all walking in. And again, I'm not telling tales out of school. I'm on the committee, but you know what I'm saying. Making an example. So yes, timing is part of it. This is two defensemen in the class, which is very unusual. But I think this was an oversight. What is it, a mistake? I guess you'd have to say, because I was on the committee for the last 5 or 6 years, so I guess you'd have to say in a given year, Should one or both of these guys have found a win, maybe?
Will Nault, you're with us as well. Brian Burke joins us on Boomer in the Morning.
Brian, just curious your thoughts with some of the outbreaks in the U.S. I know the NHL has talked about how tight the bubble is going to be in a place like Vegas, but you know, you've seen the situation in Florida, many questioning the NBA and the MLS plan there. Your thoughts on hub cities in the U.S. where things are really kind of blowing up?
Well, I don't – if they do the bubble properly, the way it's been explained to me, and Vegas is a perfect bubble, the way it's been explained to me, that's truly where they can have virtually zero contact with civilians who are not tested, not quarantined. The other ones are more problematic, and I heard Elliot Friedman speculating what he heard, and again, I don't know if this is true, and he's not sure, but he heard that the hang-up in British Columbia is – not that they haven't done a good job, but it's at what point would the province shut down the hub city in the event of positive tests? And apparently he said in BC it's a very low number. So, And you notice in the baseball and basketball and UFC, golf, they're not letting one test shut anything down. They're quarantining those athletes and they're continuing to train. So if that's a holdup, then that's good for Alberta, I guess. But I do think there's value. I really do think there's value in being a hub city. And not so much economic, although there would be hotel rooms and meals for just a small, those eight cohorts of 50. But that's a sizable bill over the course of a few weeks. It's a good injection of cash, but also every news outlet from all around the globe will be standing in front of Rogers Arena in either city and saying, live from Vancouver, or live from Edmonton. People remember that stuff, and they see Edmonton and BC in the summer when it's so beautiful in both those places. And I think it's a real driver. I think I'm impressed with the premiers that they've grasped that and gone after this event that hard.
Now, you mentioned the positive tests, and that's, I think, the one thing everyone's kind of wondering. And you know, how many do you think would knock a team out? How big does a roster need to be? I know they're talking in Major League Baseball to have kind of a list of 60 guys. I don't think, obviously, hockey's going to have a list that big, but you know, if Team X has four positive tests, Brian, that puts a big dent in their lineup.
Yeah, and I don't know what the answer to that is, and the league would have to decide, And the NHLPA would have to decide, and obviously it would depend on who the players are. If it's Brian Burke, no big deal, but if it's a good player, then that's going to be a problem. So this could be, you know, if your best player is taken out of the lineup, and there's a rumor here that Austin Matthews contracted COVID-19 last week. And if that were true and you take him out of the lineup, that's a very different lineup than with a superstar player out of the lineup. That's a very different lineup. So I don't know the answer to the question, what's the magic number? I think I'm told that teams were allowed to be up to 30 skaters and unlimited goalies, or 27 skaters and unlimited goaltenders. What if both your goaltenders got it? You know, even if the magic number was four, and you say, we've only got two positive tests, but it's our starter and our backup. And they're worried about the older coaches and staff members. Like, I turned 65 very soon. If I were still with the Flames, there would be doctors that would advise me not to go along with the team to wherever we're going for the playoffs. So that there's – and in the NHL, there's, I think, three coaches, four head coaches over 60. I think Claude Julien – Rick Bonus. So that's a concern. So we'll see. I am impressed with the way the league's getting after it. I am getting tired of the speculation about the hub cities. I wish they could nail us down. And if we here in Canada get no hub cities, and it's because the feds dallied on this, that's a shame. That's wrong.
And finally, because it is tomorrow, and you promised us that we were allowed to ask you again so you could rant, the NHL draft lottery is tomorrow, Brian. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I you guys know the answer. I know why we have a draft lottery. We have to. I think it should involve this year only the seven teams that missed the playoffs, because we had an artificial system. And I think the notion that teams that play in the play-in round can move up in this draft, I think it's obscene. I think we need a draft lottery, but it should be the smallest number of teams involved. We want the worst team to get the best player. That's the whole point of inverse order in the draft, inverse order of finish. So we want, if you're the 31st team in the league, you should get the best player. You should get Lafreniere. But because teams tank, we can't do that. So what's the lottery? So for me, lottery should be five teams max. Those other, there are teams that just missed the playoffs that had 12, 14, 15 more points than another team that pick ahead of that team. Nico Hischier, teams move up and draft guy. That's wrong. It's stupid. Like, this is one, I think the NHL is really good at 90% of what they do, 95%. This is one that I think is really stupid and unfair.
That's a good rant. We'll let it end there. Brian, congrats on being part of the Hall of Fame thing. I know it's always a fun day, and here's hoping by November, maybe you can have a ceremony to celebrate everybody.
I hope so. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Burke.